neutralinos, squares, and leptons. There was this guy here, I think Shane, was asking about the photinomas. He was wondering if the photinomas was breaking gauge invariance or not. So let's just answer his question in his absence. So you remember a linear order, the gauge transformation of a gauge field is equals to some parameter alpha, the gauge parameter, plus for the non-abelian case you get G F A B C, the structure functions C mu B alpha C. So you see the gauge transformation contains this part that is just a derivative of the parameter plus something that is only non-zero for non-abelian gauge theories. And you see, here I have a mu index, so I need a mu index and a mu index. And of course, the transformation has to be proportional to the parameter, because when we send to the parameter to zero, there is no gauge transformation anymore. All right? So when you try to see if a mass term is gauge invariant or not, so you will do this. And then this guy is precisely proportional to d mu alpha, d mu alpha. So the fact that you cannot write down a gauge, a mass for the photon, or a mass for an SU2 or SU3 gauge boson when gauge invariant is not broken is precisely coming from this term. Now, what about the photino? The transformation under gauge transformations of the gaugino. Now, notice there is no mu here, right? So it has to be proportional to the parameter. It has to be proportional to the same guy again. So let's do B and C, and it's going to be just FABC. All right? So the big difference between the gauge transformations of the vector boson and the gaugino is precisely that there is no such term here. So when you try to write down or see if the gaugino mass is gauge invariant or not, what you are going to see is that it's twice the mass lambda A delta lambda A under gauge. And this is precisely, let me just do proportional to lambda A F A B C lambda B alpha C. And this guy, the structure functions for an non-abelian gauge theory are precisely and totally antisymmetric. Whereas these two guys, this term is symmetric in AB. So this guy is antisymmetric in AB, whereas this guy is symmetric in AB. So it goes to zero. This is to say that writing down a gaugino mass breaks supersymmetry, but it doesn't break gauge invariance. So answering Shane's question, the gaugino mass is okay under gauge invariance. It doesn't break SU2 or U1. All right, yes, that was just a little discussion. Now we are going to move on into other reasons why we like supersymmetry. Oh, you want some people like supersymmetry. So the other day we described the MSSM. That's the simplest supersymmetric model. And it has a bunch of new particles, double the particles of the standard model, or degrees of freedom, and of the order of 125 parameters extra from the standard model. So from this perspective, you are adding this superstructure just to solve the problem of the Higgs. So it's very nice to know if there are extensions of the Poincaré algebra, but the practical reason why we needed some supersymmetry is because the Higgs is unstable under radiative corrections. So you may ask yourself, I mean, all this just to save the Higgs? No, there are two more things that are interesting in supersymmetry. One thing that is interesting is that it gives a candidate for dark matter. And the other interesting aspect of supersymmetry is that it can provide gauge coupling unification. So let's discuss first dark matter. So dark matter in SUSY or in the MSS. All right. The way we got into dark matter in SUSY historically is trying to solve the proton decay problem. You know that the current bounds on the proton lifetime are of order or bigger than 10 to the 33 years. So you build up experiments that are really big experiments looking for rare decays with a very low noise. And you look for rare decays such as a proton suddenly decides to decay into something else. So typically you look into a proton decays into a positron and a pion, or a proton decays, for example, into a kaon and neutrino. You probably heard about Super Kamiokande and how they were able to observe neutrino oscillations. The same type of experiment that is able to look at neutrino interactions is also the type of experiment that will be able to see this kind of very rare decays. So Super Kamiokande is also imposing bounds on the proton lifetime. So what am I saying, that dark matter and proton decay are related, is because if we have SUSY and all these new particles, we could imagine that there will be something like this, for example, D and U exchange and Skork, for example, this guy. This is just an example. And this guy decays into E plus and U star. And if you put an spectator U just going to U, this is telling you that your initial proton could decay to a positron and a pion by exchanging one of these new particles. All right. Just the excited state of the U. No, sorry, U star is, let's say, U dagger. Or anti U, whatever you want. Yeah, that's the pion is U, U bar. At least one part of the pion is precisely U, U bar. So the proton could spontaneously decay into an electron and a pion. These guys are lighter than the proton by exchanging this new particle. So you can compute what is this diagram, what will be the lifetime of the proton, and this is completely ruled out. So the idea is we are going to impose a symmetry that protects supersymmetry from inducing this kind of decays. A very simple symmetry, and you heard about this already, is if you see this coupling is standard model particles squared multiplied by new physics, right? Two standard model particles, one new physics particle. So imagine that we impose a discrete symmetry. A Z2 symmetry such that the standard model transforms trivially under the symmetry, whereas the new physics is odd under this symmetry. We saw about this symmetry before because I told you that one way of avoiding the bounds was to say that standard model particles can only pair produce new physics. And one way of imposing this kind of pair production is using this symmetry. Alright? Okay. So that means that if couplings that are allowed are always, for example, new physics squared times a standard model. So to have a coupling that is allowed under this discrete symmetry, at least I need two new physics particles. An even number of new physics particles. So the symmetry forbids this kind of decay. Alright. In the case of supersymmetry, the Z2 symmetry, the parity, is called R parity. So under R parity, the standard model is even, whereas all the supersymmetric partners are odd. Alright, so now there is an important consequence of having a conserved R parity, or any parity, is that imagine we look at the lightest new physics particle. What it means is that this new physics particle cannot decay directly into another new physics particle because it's the lightest. So it can only decay into standard model particles. Then you want new physics and some kind of decay to standard model particles. But that means that this coupling has any number of standard model particles, so let's say we have n standard model particles. Under the Z2 symmetry that goes as even to the power of n, odd, because we have one single new physics particle. So under Z2, this guy is odd. So it's impossible. So there is no such coupling of one single new physics particle to any number of standard model particles because it's forbidden by the Z2 symmetry. So what do you think is the consequence of that? Yes, because it can decay, it is stable. And we already discussed how supersymmetric particles are massive. And if you make it neutral, and also we know that it has electroweak couplings because the supersymmetric particles are just copies of standard model particles. So it's a stable, massive, neutral particle with electroweak couplings. Yes. So imagine that the standard model, the dark matter particle wasn't neutral, so it will interact with the photon. So you could have scatterings of dark matter with photons, and you will see those scatterings through gamma rays. The fact that dark matter particles don't seem to interact, at least they don't seem to interact with photons, with light, meaning that it's neutral, not like. Yes, so what we know from supersymmetry is that it is stable, it is massive, and it has electroweak couplings. The fact that it is neutral is something we have to make sure that it happens. Because if it wasn't neutral, you will see some scatterings with light, and we haven't seen that. So there are very strong bounds of the electrical charges of these particles. So this is a dark matter particle. And as we discussed, if the mass of this particle is order electroweak scale, the couplings are electroweak. Well, so you're going to have the WIMP miracle. So your back on the envelope computation will tell you that this is a good candidate for dark matter. All right. Yes? No, actually, before breaking supersymmetry, there is a... Supersymmetry is a big structure of symmetries, right? One of them is called, it's a continuous symmetry called U1R. U1R symmetry is it's kind of weird because it acts differently in the same multiplet. For example, a mu and lambda a, the Gauge Inno and the Gauge bosons don't behave the same under a U1R symmetry. The mass of the Gauge Inno, this guy will write down M LA. This doesn't break Gauge symmetry, as we were saying, but it breaks U1R. So you know U1R is broken, but you can break it in a way where the U1R breaks down to R parity. So it is natural and supersymmetric to have a parity. It's not by hand. All right. So SUSY has so much structure that is able to produce a WIMP. Usual WIMPs for supersymmetry are, they have to be neutral. So what do you think are candidates for WIMPs in supersymmetry? Joe? No idea? From the guys we saw last time that are neutral. Who are neutral? So we saw the Higgs sector, the Gauge-Inno sector, and the Skorkanes leptons. So the Skorkanes leptons are not neutral, they are not good. But in the Gauge-Inno sector, you have neutral guys, right? Like we call them neutralinos. Yes, so the WIMP is generally a neutralino. And you remember we call this guy chi zero. The lightest neutralino is a candidate for dark matter. All right. So the conclusion of this discussion about the parity is that any theory, with a parity and new states at the electroweak scale could give you a dark matter candidate. Supersymmetry is a particular case of this feature. So any theory which has some kind of parity and new states at the electroweak scale, well, it's going to give you some kind of WIMP. All right. So now this is one reason why we like supersymmetry, because trying to solve the proton decay problem. So in SUSY, the proton decay problem leads to a rationale for dark matter. What we are going to see now is that there is another nice feature of supersymmetry, is gauge coupling unification. So I guess when you did your homework on SU5, you could see that if you look at the mu dependence of the different gauge coupling, so instead of the gauge coupling, I'm going to write the inverse of the gauge coupling squared divided by 4 pi, okay, of the alphas. So you know these couplings because the loop effects run, and you can see they're running. And in the case of the standard model, the running is something like this. But this is alpha 1 over alpha 1, 1 over alpha 2, 1 over alpha 3. where 1, 2, and 3 just means the SU1 hyperchart, SU2 left, and SU3 color. So you look at the running of the different coupling forces of nature, you see that in the standard model they don't seem to unify. That's probably. Yes, you're right. It's 1 over alpha, yes. Because this is the strongest at low energies, this is the weakest at low energies. So. Okay. So, of course, we just have two forces in nature, they always unify at some scale, but because we have three, the standard model doesn't unify. But if it did, it would be very nice. It would mean that we think on this diversity in nature of having three kinds of couplings, three kinds of forces. But actually, this is just a fake. It's because we had a higher symmetry, gauge symmetry at high scales, that it got broken down to this substructure. So if the gauge couplings unify at some scale, you could understand that there is only one single force in nature. So that's something cute that you want, especially for physicists who like to be reductionistic. But there is no experimental evidence of that. So this is a completely biased view for a theorist. We would like to have gauge coupling unification because it's cute, but there is no experimental evidence. Whereas dark matter is an evidence. So we want to explain that for sure. Well, if we'll discuss about that when we talk about the supersymmetry breaking mechanisms. We see, well, I'm going to say that if you measure all these masses and you spend 20 years measuring these parameters, you may run down and see the unification of the scale. Yeah, so it is difficult. Okay, so yeah, this is like religion. If you really like that, you go for that, but it's really, there is no evidence. And really measuring something that leads to gauge coupling unification will be difficult. Okay. Except proton decay, we are going to see that one. Okay, so gauge coupling unification is something cute that could be right. But the idea, the gap idea is precisely, I have a very large group. For example, SU5 or SO10. And these guys have enough generators as to contain the standard model. So the idea is I start with a very big group, one single force, and somehow these guys, there is some scalars that get vet and break spontaneously these symmetries to the standard model. That's the gut idea. And the idea will be, okay, if that's the case, and I start running my gauge couplings, I will see that at some point the three couplings unify, and then they stay unified. So this is one force. This is the standard model. And this is 1 over alpha. At the scale at which these guys unify, it's called the Grand Unification scale, Grand Unified Theories scale, and the idea is that you should look at this in the other way around. So you start with the universe at very high energies, you go down, down, down in energy, the universe cools down and expands and all these things, and at some point there is something, some spontaneous breaking of this very big symmetry. And this breaking leads to three different gauge groups that run independently. That's the gut idea. So, big success of supersymmetry, or seeming like a big success, is that at one loop, if you look at the conditions for SU5 unification, for example, and look at the content of the MSSM, at one loop, the MSSM unifies. So that, those are good news. The bad news is that if you look at the same unification at two loops, you start seeing that they really don't unify. This goes a little bit like this. This goes. There are differences that make this guy to not unify. So because at two loops, the unification is lost, well, so at two loops, you have to start arguing that maybe there are some threshold effects that bring back these couplings to unify. So this becomes very model dependent. So it was cute, but when you look in detail, as usual, it doesn't work so well. So talking about predictions for GAN unification, GAN unification actually predicts some degree of proton decay. So let's see this bounce. Yes. Because it's two curves, they had to unify, yes.
Okay, but like, on the graph you drew, you only measured the low energy part, right?
That's yes. Yes.
Why do we draw them as they intersect and they carry on and split up again?
All right, okay. So, in the standard model, there is no unification. Like, imagine I do this. I could also continue doing like this. They really don't unify. It's just two curves are going to intersect at some point. Depends on what you believe is here, new states and thresholds. So you realize also, whenever you add new states at any energy, your relations of your renormalization group equations are going to be modified. So one argument that supports GAN unification is also to assume that there is a desert. So it's this desert idea. That there are no new states, or if there are new states, they have to be of a very particular kind to really get unification. This is kind of weird. It doesn't make sense from what we've seen so far, because every time we go to a one order of magnitude in energy, we see more particles. So the idea is that somehow there is a mess here at below the electroweak scale, and afterwards there is a desert. No new physics, nothing fun, just the MSSM, and we are done with it. So for if you believe in GAN unified theories, you also have to believe that there is there is almost no content between the electroweak scale and the GAN scale. And that's called the desert. So, GAN unified theories reintroduce the problem of proton decay. Normal GATs, for example, SU5 or SO10, without supersymmetry, tend to predict that the proton will decay into an electron and a pion. And the kind of diagrams that do that is, for example, in these GAN unified theories, we are going to have a bunch of gauge bosons at high energies. And after this guy breaks spontaneously to the standard model, the broken generators are going to be eaten, and then you will have a bunch of extra gauge bosons at the scale of GAN unification. On the same way that we have a zeta and a w at the electroweak scale. Because the GAT symmetry is broken, let's say, of M GAT, then you expect some gauge bosons, let's call them X and Y, that will have very heavy masses. So those guys are heavy, let's say 10 to the 14, 10 to the 16 GeVs, but still, they can mediate things like this. It's leads to Pettone decay, because you have baryon number in one side and you have lepton number in the other side. Callum, did they see in SU5 how leptons and quarks are on the same representations? So you could see that in 5, for example, of SU5, you have leptons and quarks all together. That's why a gauge boson is able to talk to a lepton and a quark, because they are in the same SU5 representations. So these GARN unified theories are nice, but at the same time, they have a strong prediction. It's like, for example, if you look at 5, this is going to be 5, but for example, DC plus a lepton. Or if you look at the 10 of SO10, you will see UC plus Q plus EC. So they got gauge bosons are able to go from one guy, the quark, to the lepton. So a prediction of GARN unified theories is that there will be some degree of proton decay. And because these theories are based on one single symmetry, it's very big symmetry, but it's one single symmetry, there are lots of constraints. So if you assume SU5 or SO10 unification, and ask for gate coupling unification, you end up with a prediction of where is NGAT, the unification scale, so where are the masses of these gauge bosons, and also what kind of representations, irreducible representations, you have. For example, the fact that a phi contains a lepton and a quark. So you can work out what is the proton decay rate in this kind of theories. So I don't want to bore you. I'm just going to give you a rough view of what's going on with gauge coupling unification. So you look at the searches that have been done so far on proton decay. Those come from, for example, Sudan, Fujus, or IMB, Kamiokande. And the most precise one is Super Kamiokande. They bound the proton lifetime to be 10 to the 32 to 34. Sure. It's bigger than, sorry. 10 to the 34 years in the proton 2e pion channel. Whereas in the case of the proton 2k neutrino, the bands are a little bit looser, 3.3, 10 to the 33 years. That's easy to remember. That's the only thing I remember. Whereas the typical predictions for SUSY and non-SUSY is SUSY and non-SUSY GATs are that the proton lifetime is of order 10 to the 32 to 34 years. So we are in trouble. So you see, if you look at the numbers in particular, non-SUSY GATs, at least the simplest non-SUSY GAT, like SO10 SU5, without adding extra engineering, they are ruled out. SUSY GATs, like for example SU5 SUSY or SO10 SUSY, most of the parameter space of SU5 SUSY is ruled out, and a bunch of the parameter space for SO10 is ruled out. So there is some tension here. So we are going to do a homework about GAN unification, but seems to be in trouble with the current bounds from photon decay. So the idea is cute, but it seems to be in trouble with experiment, which is great. Yes. But then, of course, there are so many theories. You can always have guts plus what I call engineering, and you avoid bounds. That's fine. But the engineering is precisely to avoid the proton decay, and it kind of sucks. So yeah. Then you may ask, when are we going to rule out the whole parameter space of SU5 and SO10? So about 2015, Super Kamio Kande, in 2015, it will be able to reach the 10 to the 34 years for this channel. That will rule out most of SU5. SU5 will be dead. And if you want to go to 10 to the 35, then you need to wait for the water Cherenkov, like bigger experiments, and it will take 10 more years. But even at that level, guts are really in bad shape. For sure, non-SUSY guts are in very, very bad shape, and supersymmetric guts are kind of pushed farther away. All right. Questions about this? So you see, proton decay was the rationale for dark matter in supersymmetry, and proton decay seems to be killing the idea of GAN unification in supersymmetry. So what we are going to do now is to step back a little bit, and we are going to discuss about the things we've seen so far about supersymmetry. So what is cool about SUSY? SUSY is the maximum extension of the Poincaré algebra, plus it protects the Higgs. So we can make sense of a scalar theory in supersymmetry. Any complaints about this? Are you doing Facebook? So that's cute, but what did we say about supersymmetry? Is supersymmetry a stack symmetry of nature? No, supersymmetry is broken, right? Everybody should get more coffee. You are undercaffeinated. So we discussed how supersymmetry has to be broken, otherwise we will have a bunch of selectrons down there, and we haven't seen them. So SUSY is broken, okay? So because SUSY is broken, that's very cute, but we have to break SUSY, which introduces the arbitrariness of a bunch of parameters. All right? So SUSY is broken, and this is something we have to face. It's very cute, but it's broken. Okay? Yes, the soft. We had to introduce this Lagrangian of soft masses. So you remember masses for the scalars, masses for the Gaetinos, and also we could also write some kind of scalar, 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 trilinear. It's only three types of terms, but given the content of the MSSM, there are, in those three types of terms, we have on the 124 new parameters. So that's one thing. sushi is nice, but it's broken. We are fine with that because we are always breaking down symmetries. And what we want is those symmetries to be resilient and low energies. Okay. We have some predictions coming from sushi, even if sushi is broken. Second thing is that sushi provides a dark matter candidate. Oh, that's great. Any comments about that? Negative comments. So it's such a cool thing that it provides a dark matter candidate. We know that this is not a specific of supersymmetry. This is provided by any theory with a parity and electroweak scale new states. So that's nothing to like jump on supersymmetry, because really any theory can do it. So that's one point. Z2 plus electroweak states also do the job. And also, you look in detail, at the dark matter candidate in supersymmetry, it is very fine-tuned. So you look at, for example, CDMS results, the most recent results, they are killing more and more supersymmetry as a source of dark matter. Yes?
So that Z2 symmetry, do you impose it on the supersymmetry, or do you look for a particle that has that symmetry?
So you mean how do I obtain it, or how do I look for it?
How do you obtain it?
Okay, in supersymmetry there is a rational why there is a parity at low energies. The idea is that when you look at in supersymmetry, it's a symmetry of space-time, so besides, one of the consequences is that in supersymmetry there is a symmetry called U and R symmetry, R symmetry. You know this symmetry is broken, again, but you can break it in a way that preserves some subset. So U1R contains a Z2 symmetry called R parity. And the Gicino masses break U1R, but do not break this parity. So it's a reason why there could be a parity in supersymmetry. So it's better than just imposing it by hand. There is a reason in supersymmetry. So, but the main problem nowadays is you look in detail on the supersymmetric dark matter, there is always a tension with the most current direct detection experiments. So the whip idea in supersymmetry is kind of pushed to a corner. Yes? You mean why call it neutralino when it could be any neutral state with protected by a parity? Yes, exactly correct. Yes. So you could do that. Add a scalar so you don't have problems with anomalies. Imposing this scalar at the Z2 symmetry, you are done. Indeed. Yes. This is one problem. You can always say. You need a little bit of coupling. Yes. But you know, this is. Give me an infinite amount of parameters and I will solve every problem, right? Like a particle for dark matter, a particle for this. Yes, you can. Yes. All right. So that's cool. A cool dark matter candidate, you look in detail, it's kind of crumbling. I want you to read the introduction and the abstract, the introduction and conclusions of a paper. I'm trying to find the. Ah, yes. The title is funny. The well tempered neutralino. This is by Judice, I think. Judice and Alcani Hamed, and I think Delgado. I just want you to read the intro and conclusions. This paper is very old, much before the current CDMS results were out there. And already at that state, we knew that there was some kind of fine-tuning going on with our matter. So I want you to read that to get a feeling of the fine-tuning of dark matter in supersymmetry. And then tomorrow we can discuss about this paper. And the final point of our supersymmetry is gauge coupling unification. So it's a beautiful idea. It's a theoretical bias, no evidence of that. The only prediction is that there will be proton decay, seems to be quite ruled out by current experiments. And in any case, you know that this unification in the MSSM happens at one loop, but at two loops it is destroyed. So you need to add more stuff, more engineer. So it's cute, not clear that MSSM is able to do it. All right. Any questions?
It's a fair question,
but remember the lifetime is just, you know, what is the peak of the distribution?
Because they have a lot of groups, yeah, I forgot.
Yes, so even if they are off the peak of the Gaussian, you can still get some bounce from there. Yeah, no, that sounds very good. All right. Any questions?
Somebody told me that the LHC has put a minimum bound on the light supersymmetric partner or something at 800 GeV, and there's an upper limit as well. So if that's completely ruled out, would it rule out supersymmetry, or would it rule out just a particular model of...
A particular model of supersymmetry, unfortunately.
Which model?
In fact, if it's so strict, it must be M sub, minimal supergravity, which is, you know, that some guys decided one day to write down some particular model. And because they were famous and it happened 20 years ago, they are still looking for it. Yes?
What is the upper bound?
The
upper bound? We were talking about this.
Ah, yes. Okay. So one thing you know for sure is that if the one very clean experiment was left, we always come back to left. So there are bounds on things like this. If the Z couples to the neutralino, the neutralino is a neutral particle. It means that there is nothing in the detector to detect it. So what you will see is that the Z is produced and nothing comes out. This is what experimentally is called missing energy. In this case, transverse energy, because this is what they can reconstruct. So from things like this, if the mass of the neutralino was half of the Z, we would have produced it, and we will be able to impose a bound looking at the missing energy distribution. So the Z is 91 GeV, so neutralino is heavier than that. But as everything, there are always loopholes, caveats. I can always do weird things. For example, I can produce a state that is so close to another new state that it decays to this state producing something very soft. And this will be missed by the experiment because the experiment needs some quantity of energy to be deposited. So you can always find loopholes for these bounds.
Would that come from relic abundance? Like if these are supposed to be lattice supersymmetric partners?
There are ways around too. You could have a super heavy guy that the coupling is very suppressed.
Right. So it's not really an upper band, not a strict upper band.
And you will see that the homework this week will be something called a split supersymmetry, where you send the supersymmetric scale, breaking scale, to be as much as you want, gap scale. So there is. You realize that we are breaking supersymmetry, and we are asking for this breaking to happen at the electroweak scale. We are tying up these two things. So you must explain why these two things are there. It could be that supersymmetric nature is supersymmetric, but this supersymmetry is realized at a scale that we will never reach. And we are asking for these two scales, electroweak symmetry breaking and supersymmetry breaking, to be at the same order, on the same order.
That's how it's called the hierarchy.
To solve the hierarchy problem, to get the dark matter candidate, we need this coincidence. All right, so let me start with all these details. The fine details about supersymmetry depends on how we break supersymmetry. So let's break supersymmetry. Supersymmetry breaking. We know that supersymmetry, if supersymmetry is not broken, then the supersymmetric generators will destroy the vacuum. Sorry. This is the statement that the vacuum is invariant under supersymmetry. All right. So supersymmetry is preserved if this happens. And you also know that the algebra of supersymmetry is something like this. 2 sigma. Probably Freddy did that already, but I'm going to do it again. So you can use the fact that the trace of sigma bar mu is equals 1 and get that p mu, this guy here, is actually 1/4. Sigma mu. Q that. So you can express the energy momentum vector as something related to the algebra of supersymmetric charges. So in particular, if we look at the zero component, we are going to have, okay, so this is 1/4. Of Q1 dagger plus Q1 dagger Q1. This is just the anticommutator. Plus the same with 2. So this is the energy, the Hamiltonian of our system. So we can look at what is the expectation value of the Hamiltonian. And this is going to be 1/4. And then you get things like Q dagger 0 plus the same Q dagger Q 0, where I is 1 and 2. But what is this? These kind of things are the norm of this operator. Yes?
What is mu
Yes, so... Ah, yes, 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 sorry, yes. Thank you. Okay. What is important is that this guy is just the norm of Q dagger Q. So this is equal to 1/4 of the norm of Q over the vacuum squared plus the norm of Q dagger over the vacuum squared. You probably heard about, like, did some Hilbert space stuff somewhere. Okay. So what this expression means is that the expectation value of the Hamiltonian is the sum of two positive things. So this guy is bigger or equal than zero. Right? So if Susie is, well, let me do it here. If Susie's supersymmetry is an exact symmetry, that means that this guy over the vacuum is zero, this guy over the vacuum is zero. So we have that the expectation value of the Hamiltonian in a supersymmetric vacuum is zero. So if supersymmetry is broken, well, this is going to be that this guy is positive. Strictly positive, yep. Thank you. It's clear you did your PhD on that. All right. So now we have a condition for supersymmetry breaking. We want the Hamiltonian to have an expectation value that is bigger than zero. That will signal that supersymmetry is spontaneously broken. All right, so let's do that. So what is the Hamiltonian? The Hamiltonian is the kinetic part and the potential. So if there are no core condensates, for example, or for example, things that depend on the space-time that could produce a ref in the kinetic term, for example, instantons, small domain walls. Essentially, if there are no non-perturbative effects, then writing this expectation value is the same as writing the expectation value for the potential. So we are going to do that. We are going to look at the potential because it's very constrained by supersymmetry. And we want to look for a spontaneous breaking of supersymmetry. All right. So you remember we did the Carroll supermultiplet? And when you look at the Lagrangian, it has things like kinetic terms for the scalar and for the fermion. And also has things like -1/2, the derivative of the superpotential with respect to the scalar square minus this other guy. What is the Lagrangian, supersymmetric Lagrangian for the superpotential? So for the supermultiple, we saw there have kinetic terms, this guy here, and something that is just a mass term for the fermions. and interactions of fermions and scalars. So the potential part for the current Lagrangian is precisely this. And we had defined that the F term was precisely the derivative of the superpotential respect to the scalar. All this is just to say that in the case of the chiral supermultiple, the potential is simply F complex conjugate, because it's this term squared, whereas you can also add the contribution to the potential coming from the gauge supermultiple, and then it's just the D term squared. Right? So the potential in supersymmetry has two possible contributions, F-term contributions and D-term contributions. This comes from the chiral and for the vector supermultiples. So the way we are going to break supersymmetry, guess what? We need somebody. Yes. D? You remember? I was very rough talking about the gauge multiple. You remember we were talking about it has a vector guy, a gaugino, and to match the degrees of freedom, we needed an extra component, the D term. So the D term, you can write it in terms of the scalar. This is really not important. What matters is that the possible expectation values for the potential are either because there is some F term that gets a F or a D term that gets a F. So we can break supersymmetry spontaneously either or because this is different from zero and or. VA is different from zero. So this is called F-term breaking. And this is called D-term breaking. So now we say that supersymmetry is a global symmetry. Now this global symmetry is spontaneously broken. What do we expect? Never? If it was gauge, yes. But we are talking about a global symmetry, not gauge symmetry, not local. And it's spontaneously broken. There was this theorem by this guy, Goldstone theorem. So when you break spontaneously a global symmetry, you expected Goldstone bosons. But now the symmetry is fermionic, it's not bosonic. So you expect Goldstone fermions. Yes. Perfect. You are talking. Okay, so we expect Goldsteinos. This is because we say that this theory is global. Now, we know that at the end of the day, this theory will be gauge, it will be local, and it will be supergravity. So, global SUSY, spontaneous breaking, implies the presence of Goldsteinos, so spin one half fermions that become massless. And now, if you say, okay, I don't believe in global supersymmetry, actually I know that at the end of the day we'll have to do some kind of gauge supersymmetry. Gauge SUSY is called supergravity. And why am I telling you this? Is because what happens when you break a gauge symmetry spontaneously? we had this picture where we produce these would-be Goldstone bosons, and those are eaten by the Gauge bosons, and then they become massive. So here is exactly the same. These Goldstinos are actually would-be Goldstinos, and they will be eaten by somebody. This somebody has to be a fermion, because it's going to be eaten another fermion. Can you imagine what kind of fermion will eat the Goldstinos? So we need the Gauge boson of gravity. What is the Gauge boson of gravity? Graviton. And because it's supersymmetric, it will have a partner called gravitino. If supergravity is not broken, the gravitino will be massless. But when supergravity is spontaneously broken, the gravitino eats the Goldstinos, and it becomes massive. So in the case of supergravitin, the Goldstinos are eaten by the gravitino. So in supergravity, you expect the gravitino, if supergravity is spontaneously broken, to be massive. So you know, what is the spin of a graviton? Yes. So the graviton is a spin 2. The gravitino is 1/2 more, 3/2. That's the gravitino. It's a Rarita's finger field. And there we had to stop because we don't know how to do quantum field theories of spin higher than that. But at least 3/2 we know. So if you get a massless spin 3/2 particle, you have two ellipses, plus or minus 3/2. Whereas massive gravitino will have plus or minus 3/2, plus or minus 1/2. So the gravitino becomes massive by eating the Goldstinos, which will end up being these helicities, one plus or minus 1/2. Okay, so one consequence of supersymmetry breaking is the presence of these Goldstinos. And in the case of supergravity, these Goldstinos will lead to a massive gravitino. And I think I'll continue tomorrow. Any questions? Yes. All what we are doing so far is talking about supersymmetry as a global symmetry, right? But if you take supersymmetry as a gauge symmetry, local symmetry, it's a symmetry of space-time that you make local. It has to be gravity. And now if it's a supersymmetric gravity, supergravity, then you are going to have, besides the graviton, a gravitino. The graviton has to stay massless because, you know, GR is correct, as far as we know. So the only guy that can become massive is the gravitino. How does it? Well, it eats these Goldstinos. All right.